All right, we're ready to hear argument in Buwari versus United States, and we will hear first from Mr. Iredell.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ghassan Buwari was held for 560 days on charges as to which we submit there was no probable cause, before the government dismissed those charges. The court has provided to counsel some questions that I think I should begin by answering as part of our submission to the court. The first question essentially is, what were the charges specifically against Ghassan Buwari? He was named in two counts, count 12, which charged aiding and abetting as well as a substantive violation of section 1956 A, 3A and B, and 18 U.S.C. section 2. And the language of that count, count 12, which was before the court, was that he and his half-brother, who was one of the three other co-defendants of the case, aiding and abetting one another and others with the intent to promote the carrying on of specified unlawful activity and intent to conceal and disguise the nature, location, source, ownership, and control of property believed to be proceeds of specified unlawful activity.
Can I ask you, as to the aiding and abetting, is the fabricated testimony relevant to that claim, or is it only relevant to this under the substantive money laundering charge?
Your Honor, it is our submission that it's relevant to both those charges, because even though an aider and abettor need not commit all of the acts or elements of the underlying crime, the aider and abettor must share the relevant mens rea that would be required for conviction of the underlying crime. In other words, the aider and abettor, for instance, might not complete a full transaction, may only assist with part of the events, but that must be done with the mens rea that would be the same as required for conviction as a principle.
So more specifically then, if we're just for the moment talking about aiding and abetting, although I do want to know more about whether there's also a substantive charge, but let's talk about aiding and abetting for now. The aider and abettor has to have the intent to promote the carrying on of specified unlawful activity and the intent to conceal and disguise the nature, location, source, ownership, and control of property believed to be the proceeds of specified unlawful activity. Is that your position?
Yes.
Now, does the aider and abettor, is the specific language, which is what you specifically claim the fraud was about, represented by federal law enforcement officer to be proceeds of specified illegal activity, does that have to go to the aider and abettor as well?
Well, I need to answer with respect to the case law. The answer with respect to the case law is that it needs to have been made to somebody, either the aider and abettor or the principal, and all of the relevant criminal actors have to be aware of the nature of that representation, although it need not be made specifically to each and every participant in the offense.
You would get that out of the intent to promote the carrying out of specific unlawful activity, because they have to know what specified unlawful activity, and later on it says what specified unlawful activity is, to wit, monies derived from narcotics trafficking or from trans and so on. So that's specified unlawful activity, and that is wrapped into the intent. But does he also have to know that this representation was made by a federal law enforcement officer?
No. No, and theoretically, he would not know at the time of the commission of the offense that he's dealing with a federal law enforcement officer.
Aider and abettor doesn't have to. So then, to go back to Judge Nelson's question, since the alleged fraud is about whether the federal law enforcement officer told him this, how is that pertinent to the aider and abettor? Although I still want to come back to the other question.
All right. Let me make sure that I properly understand your question, Judge Berzon. Would you mind, and I beg your pardon.
What I'm trying to say is this. If the representation itself neither has to be made to the aider and abettor, nor does the aider and abettor have to know that there was a representation by a federal law enforcement officer or its agent, although they do have to know that there was specified unlawful activity and intended to conceal and so on of specified unlawful activity. How is the specific fraud alleged here, which is whether the federal law enforcement officer told him, pertinent to the aider and abetting charge?
He needs to know that the specific property involved was represented at some point by someone to be proceeds of specified unlawful activity. Because
he doesn't need to know that that was made by a federal officer.
That's exactly right. And in fact, the whole purpose of this aspect of the statute is to allow federal officers to represent the specific funds that are the subject matter of the transaction as being the fruits of unlawful activity without actually having bad money. In other words, this is the so-called sting provision of 1956, where the statute was amended to allow a sting operation, but because they were in fact not dealing with crooked money, but with funds that the government had, there was the statutory requirement that in some way.
So if we agree with you, well, let's say we agree with you that there's that there is a third charge and there's no probable cause for it for the substantive money laundering. Does it matter if we find that there's probable cause as to the aiding and abetting? And because Nevada law, I can't tell that Nevada law's looked at this. Is the best way to discern Nevada law to say, well, Nevada law has generally said we follow California and California law has adopted this. What is the idea that you have to parse these out as to each separate claim for probable cause?
Well, first of all, Judge Nelson, let me say that my research is exactly as the court has suggested. In other words, Nevada law has never specifically dealt with this issue. If you have probable cause as to one charge but no probable cause as to another, what is this result? There's no Nevada case that addresses that. However, it would seem to me that the fact is that any charge that is a false charge that is maliciously prosecuted is the subject matter.
But would it have to have an impact? Because I mean, the main problem here is that your client was detained for a year and a half. If there was probable cause on the first two claims and that was enough to detain him for the year and a half, I'm not sure it makes sense to parse him out that way. But I mean, I'm also not on the Nevada Supreme Court. So I guess a better question is, has California addressed this? Are you aware of California. I think the lay of the land is that the majority of states have said you have to parse it out state by state. Has California come into that camp to say you have to parse it out claim by claim?
I am not familiar with California law. I was limited in my research to the Nevada point, although I'm a California lawyer.
More specifically, on Judge Nelson's point, as a practical matter, whatever the law is, if I'm not sure what good it would do you to have him to parse them out, because you still have to prove damages for the illegal detention, and if he would have been detained for the same amount of time anyway, it doesn't really make any difference to your case.
Well, I am aware of essentially the de minimis rule or the Chick Hearn rule, no harm, no foul.
Yeah, but well, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that supposing we parsed it out and we concluded that the malicious prosecution with regard to a substantive claim that inheres in this charge, which I still want to get back to, but then and so you'd win, i.e., there was malicious prosecution, but then you'd have to prove damages, and I don't see how you could prove damages from the fact that there was a malicious prosecution as to one of three charges when your damages inhere in him being detained, and he would have been detained anyway, presumably, unless you think you could prove not, which seems unlikely.
But I'm not interested in a Pyrrhic or...
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying wouldn't it be a Pyrrhic victory?
I would have to say I think that there's much in what Your Honor has to say, although as a technical matter, the legal answer should be the issue of damages is a factual one, and one could argue that had he not been charged with the substantive violation, had it been clear that there was a delineation only on a minor participation, he would not likely have been detained for 560 days. But that's a factual issue. And
right, so
I'm simply... Let me just go, if I could, Judge Berzon, and forgive me.
Now that's fine. Go ahead. I was interrupting.
I wanted to go to your point, which is, let's now go to the point, the substantive point. Was he charged substantively? The answer is yes. In that regard, the government, in their pleadings, which are cited in our excerpt, say that he was charged with both aiding and abetting and the substantive offense, as was his brother. And that's the language. But my point simply was, all three of these charges, whether it's on an aiding and abetting ground or the conspiracy or on the substantive count, all of them require that the representation had been made. And in fact, in this case, the report, which we allege, and this is all language in the complaint, we say the agent falsely claimed that he said to Ghassan.
Yes, but isn't the problem is that you haven't alleged that the agent falsely said it to Emil Edward Borari. In other words, if the agent said it to Emil Borari, that would satisfy an aiding and abetting charge, right?
The government has alleged it. In other words, as to that, if there was sufficient evidence from which one could infer that the aider and abetter knew that, yes, the answer to your question would be yes. But given this factual situation, there's no evidence of any kind that Ghassan had the requisite criminal knowledge as to any of the three charges.
But this is on a motion to dismiss, and you haven't alleged that it wasn't made to Emil Borari, so don't you have a problem?
Well,
only on the aiding and abetting.
No, I don't think so. In other words, there's nothing in the record one way or the other, and no allegation one way or the other And I don't think it's our burden in that regard to, as the, in the principal pleading, to have to negate all of the potential defenses the government might have if we properly allege the prima facie elements of the action. My time has expired.
Can we go briefly to leaving aside the substantive claim, to the probable cause on the aiding and abetting for now? And the government's position is that there was probable cause because he was in the room. He brought a money laundering, a money counting machine, and there were $60,000, and he was in the room. That's one notion. And I have difficulty seeing how you prove the intent, how that is probable cause of any intent with regard to specified unlawful activity. But then there is this tape of this conversation, which was judicially noticed. So, and the conversation, as it appears in the government's brief, is actually in the underlying case, is actually longer and somewhat more damaging to your client. So, the question is: with that, was the judicial notice proper? And with the whole dialogue included, why isn't there probable cause?
The answer is judicial notice was not appropriate for several reasons, one of which was that there was inadequate notice given to us so that we could object, because the fact is the statements, if one assumes they're true, we could show, that is to say, if one assumes they were made, we could show they were absolutely false. Because why? It's a complicated issue under Rule 806 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, but on multiple other occasions, Emil Buhari, who said many things at many times, said exactly the opposite to the agents, and they were aware of that, that Ghassan didn't have criminality in his DNA. He's not the kind of person who would be involved in this. And finally, the fact that none of these transactions involved the use of any of Ghassan's accounts, any of Ghassan's checks, any intervention or use of Ghassan in any way. So that it was an inappropriate and we feel unfair.
Even for the purpose for which it was submitted, which is to tell what a reasonable person could have thought about probable cause in light of the conversation, that conversation in out of context or out of the larger context of all the conversations was subject to interpretation, and therefore
precisely, Judge Berzon. In other words, if we had known that the district court judge intended to take judicial notice of that specific thing, we could have asked him to take judicial notice of 15 other contradictory statements, which would, under Rule 806, the Federal Rules of Evidence, completely impeach the limited out-of-context statement that was relied upon.
Impeach it in the sense that a reasonable person would not have relied on it in light of all the other ones.
100%. Especially so since, as we say, the agents falsely claimed to have made statements to Ghassan that, in fact, were never made. So that consciousness of guilt, I submit, is appropriately considered in determining whether they reasonably believed there was probable cause with which to proceed. I have exceeded my time.
Judge Beatty has a question.
I do have a question for you. I didn't want to interrupt Judge Berzon's line of questioning. I'm still not sure that your client was charged with a substantive offense. So I'm looking at count 12. I don't find that language particularly illuminating. When you were asked earlier what was the basis to say there was the third substantive charge, you cited the government's pleadings. But can you tell me more specifically what is there that shows that this was not just the aiding and abetting charge? Because that's what count 12 looks like to me. But is there some language in there that suggests there was also the substantive offense?
Yes. Let me, if I could, just refer the court to page 11 of our excerpt of record, This is quoting from the government's pleading in the district court.
But isn't the most important thing what the indictment says? So I'm looking at the indictment and count 12 in the indictment. Because it seems to me that the government and the district court both believed that there were only two charges in how this was litigated below. So,
well, may I, Judge Beatty, just tell you that that's not correct exactly as to the government. The government says plaintiff fails to grapple with the fact that the indictment charged both him and his brother with money laundering and aiding and abetting. It does not specify which brother committed the substantive offense and which brother aided and abetted. That's page 11 of the excerpt of record that we submitted. And as a pleading point, the government is quite correct. In other words, somebody can be charged, and 18 U.S.C. Section 2 is construed to be a part of every indictment, whether it's alleged specifically or not. There are cases that say that, so that he was charged under both prongs. In other words, he was charged substantively as a substantive principle, and he was also charged as an aider and abetter.
To have an aiding and abetting, you have to have a principle. And the way the thing is charged, I'm just looking at this now, I hadn't realized it. It says aiding and abetting one another. So therefore, it is charging each of them with possibly being the principal, because somebody has to be the principal. And it doesn't say
exactly.
It doesn't say which one it is. And it also goes on and says, did knowingly conduct an attempt and so on, aside from the aiding and abetting allegations. So that seems to be an affirmative charge that he actually did it. And one of them has to actually do it, right? So
the answer to that is yes, although the government points out, and believe it or not, there is case law and instructions that say the jury can convict, but they need not determine who was the aider and abetter and who was the principal if the crime was done, the defendant's involved.
Right, but they have to say that there was one. There has to be one. Right.
100%. But that's why, in this case especially, the point is that the representation that the specific funds were some way the product of unlawful activity. Now, it doesn't have to be made in that language. The person doesn't have to say, oh, by the way, Ghassan, I wanted to let you know the subject matter of this transaction is the fruit of substantive unlawful activity. It can be done in another way, like, oh, you know, this is from our prostitution business, or, you know, we did a big deal the other day, something like that. But it must be a representation made to somebody at some point. I have exceeded my time now, so I should.
We'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. And we'll hear from the government.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. Weili Shaw for the defendants, appellees. With regard to the FTCA case, the question, of course, is whether the plaintiff has adequately alleged the want of probable cause to initiate the criminal proceedings. And I just want to begin, in that analysis, we begin with the presumption of probable cause that's created by
because
the grand jury indictment.
Grand jury. What about this? It seems to me one of the major issues is whether there's a substantive charge of money laundering in count 12. What's the government's position on that?
There is only one count, one charge in count 12. And what count 12 charges is that there was a money laundering transaction that occurred in the hotel room in Miami. And aiding and abetting is simply one means by which either defendant, but in particular, I think the government had in mind the plaintiff, could be held liable for that substantive crime. And that's exactly what 18 U.S.C. 2 says. It says whoever commits an offense against the United States or aids...
Well, I don't think there's any question that it puts forward an aiding and abetting charge, but why doesn't it also put forward a substantive money laundering charge? It references 1956A3, A and B.
Right. So, I mean, what's important here, yes, it does...
You're saying that's only for purposes of the aiding and abetting. That's only to support the aiding and abetting.
Count 12 charges both defendants. It charges both Emil Bouri and plaintiff. And so it certainly is charging that a money laundering transaction within the meaning of the statute has occurred. The principal
and
offense.
And that one of them committed it.
I'm sorry?
And that one of them committed it was
yes,
the principal.
Yes. So certainly one.
And it doesn't say which one. It says the opposite. It says aiding and abetting one another. So it seems pretty clear that it is alleging that each of them was a principal.
And that is simply, I don't think that's true at all. In fact, that is exactly how aiding and abetting.
Who is alleging is the principal?
Right. That's the thing, because the indictment does not need to specify who is the principal and who is the aider and abetter.
It says aiding and abetting one another.
Right, but that's simply how aiding and abetting is charged. And
Fine, but that's because they're alleging that he's both a principal and an aider and abetter.
There is only one crime, Your Honor, and the defendants can be found guilty on either as a principal or as an aider and abetter, and the fact that there are two means of reaching that liability doesn't mean that there are two separate substantive counts.
The district court didn't actually even consider this, though, right? I mean, the district court just said there were two crimes. There's two crimes here, aiding and abetting, but it didn't consider a third crime, the substantive money laundering claim.
No, the district court never considered it. This argument
to say, hey, this is open to interpretation, is the best action to remand this and say, look, we want you to look at this.
No, I don't think so for many reasons. One, I think it's erroneous. But two, the argument was not raised before the district court. In fact, even plaintiff's own complaint says that there were two counts, an aiding and abetting count and a conspiracy count. That is how
it was pitched to the district court.
I'm sorry?
That was how it was argued to the district court.
And
so when did the third claim come up, just on appeal?
I'm not sure where it came from. I mean, the first that I sort of understood that there was even argument that there was a third complaint, I'm sorry, a third charge, was when this court entered its order. That's not how I had understood the case or anyone involved.
I have to look back at the complaint, but I thought at places he did allege it as a substantive. But let's go on with the actual charge. Then it says, aiding and abetting one another, and then it says, did knowingly conduct an attempt to conduct a financial. So it says he did it. This person, each of these persons did it. And that's consistent with the aiding and abetting one another. So it seems, I mean, I was less clear about this until I came in and stared at it some more, but it does seem to me that putting those two things together, the affirmative language about did knowingly conduct an attempt and the aiding and abetting one another, they're charging in the alternative each of them as the principal.
Well, Your Honor, the way that criminal indictments are usually written, and again, I should also point out that the criminal indictment was written by the U.S. Attorney's Office. The claims here do not pertain to the conduct of the U.S. Attorney's Office. And to the extent that, you know, there was an error in how the indictment was drafted, you know, that would not support a malicious prosecution claim based on the actions of the FBI agents. But just to back up for a minute, the way that criminal indictments are usually drafted is that they are, to the extent that there are alternative means of liability for the same crime, they are drafted in the conjunctive. So even if the statute says do X or Y, indictment is drafted as X and Y.
Your point is, you are making the point that there is somebody is guilty of money laundering, but we're not even pursuing that claim. We're only pursuing the aiding and abetting, and they helped each other in aiding and abetting. Is that a summary?
Yes, I think that, you know, if the evidence had supported it, the government could have pursued a theory where plaintiff was the principal, but that's not, in fact, what they pursued.
Was there a suggestion that somebody else was the principal and you just didn't know? Or you just said we're not pursuing a principal at all?
I'm not sure exactly how that was described in the district court, but ultimately none of this makes any difference because there's ample Ninth Circuit precedent on these kinds of questions. So one, Ninth Circuit precedent is very clear that even if the government had only charged the substantive offense, there would be an implicit aiding and abetting charge. And if the evidence at trial had only demonstrated that the defendant was guilty of aiding and abetting, it's not that the defendant would have been found not guilty of the substantive offense and guilty of aiding and abetting. He would be found guilty of money laundering under the aiding and abetting theory, as stated by 18 U.S.C. 2, which says that someone who aids and abets is punishable as a principal. So again, it's impossible to sort of draw a distinction between...
That sort of goes to my question before, which is, if there's probable cause on the aiding and abetting, then there's no... He was not wrongfully detained for the year and a half.
Yes, I think that's right. And so, for example, the punishment for aiding and abetting...
You're saying as a legal matter, they couldn't have even... Even if we were to remand this to the district court, they couldn't even show... There's no way they could legally show that he wouldn't have... that he would have been wrongfully detained for that time because it all collapses into the same analysis.
Exactly. It's a single offense with different means of liability, either as a principal or as an aider and abettor.
And the reason it makes a difference, as I understand it, is because the representation provision wouldn't have to be made to the aider and abettor.
Well, I think as opposing counsel conceded, the point is just that the representation does have to be made to someone involved in the scheme, but it doesn't. The statute doesn't specify who it has to be made to. So if it was made to Emil Bouhari and plaintiff got knowledge of that, that's fine. If it was made to the plaintiff and Emil got knowledge that way, that would also be fine. So as long as the representation was made to someone, it doesn't matter.
So going back to the beginning then, which is the probable cause question. I'd like to know how the facts on aiding and abetting, or conspiracy, but that seems easier. On aiding and abetting, how does the what was known to the police? Two questions. How was what was known to the officers demonstrate the intent to promote the carrying on of specified unlawful activity, which is defined in the indictment? Or the intent to conceal, disguise the nature, etc. How does the intent come out of the fairly sparse amount of information? And secondly, what is the place of this judicial notice in making that decision?
Absolutely. First, I'd like to just start with the probable cause standard, because again, the point here is not whether the government had proof beyond a reasonable doubt or even proof by a preponderance of the evidence that plaintiff actually had the requisite knowledge. Rather, it's only whether he had, whether there was a reasonable inference that he did or there was a substantial chance that he did. And I think the evidence amply demonstrates that the government had probable cause to make that conclusion. So first, we start with the fact that there is a undisputed money laundering transaction that is happening in the hotel room. Nowhere in the complaint does plaintiff dispute that the transaction itself satisfied, in fact, or in other words, that the substantive offense in fact occurred. And so while this was occurring with an extremely large sum of money, which is $60,000, obviously a money counter is essential to completing the transaction, and plaintiff is the one who brings the money counter to the hotel room. He doesn't just drop off the counter and leave. He stays there while the money is counted. And so I think that his involvement in providing an essential piece of the transaction or essential tool for completing the transaction is sufficient to create an inference.
Actus reus, so to speak, but what about the mens rea?
Yeah, so I think, so even based on that alone, I think it's reasonable to draw the inference that that plaintiff was complicit with the meal. But then we add to it
But that's not good enough. It has to be the intent to promote the carrying on of specified unlawful activity. And that specified unlawful activity is later defined to be the possession and sale of illegal and controlled substances and transporting, recruiting. And so he has to intend to promote the carrying on of narcotics trafficking. I used to know that, as I understand it, and prostitution, not just something or other is going on here.
So first, I would start with the fact that there's no dispute that the representation or that Emil Bouhari had the guilty knowledge. So then the inference is that plaintiff, by bringing a money counter to the transaction to assist Emil, had in fact had agreed or had some sort of complicity with Emil Bouhari in conducting the transaction. So that would permit
his brother, as I understand it, if he knew that his brother was involved in something shady, that's not good enough.
Right. He would have to have the knowledge, but I think it's permissible to draw the inference that that he had acquired the knowledge from his brother. And I should also just back up and also note that the court should only get to this if it finds that the presumption of probable cause created by the grand jury indictment has been rebutted. And I don't think plaintiff has overcome that presumption.
Well,
because
he has alleged that there was fraudulent testimony to the grand jury. And even if he doesn't have to know that even if the representation didn't have to be made to me, if they lied to the grand jury and said it was made to him, wouldn't that impeach the whole grand jury determination? Because they could have relied on that as being the representation that was made to someone, and it wouldn't be true. So why isn't that the end of the grand jury?
But there's no factual basis in the complaint for concluding that the agents, in fact, made this lie, this purported lie to the grand jury. All they're relying on is what they say are the words in the indictment, and as I've tried to explain, that's a misunderstanding of the indictment.
But they say that repeatedly that they made this up and they lied about it to various people, and it was in police reports and other places, as I understand it. Is that right? I mean,
they've alleged that there were false statements in reports,
right.
But again,
so the
there's
inference that if they were lying to, in general, they wouldn't go and lie to the grand jury too. Is not a good, as least a good an inference as the probable causes that you're otherwise relying on.
I would disagree because I think there's just no. In fact, I would just back up and say that there is. This is a case in which there was substantial, even by plaintiff's own complaint, there was substantial documentary evidence of conversations that occurred between.
But that's a different point. That's right. That's the point that I was. The second point I wanted you to talk about.
Right, but what I meant to say was that there's no reason to think that plaintiff has not even alleged that.
That's an Iqbal point. They had to say more to prove that. They do allege that it was made to the grand jury. And they
right, but that's simply a conclusory assertion. There's no factual basis for it. In fact, they have no factual basis for even saying that the defendants in the Bivens case even testified to the grand jury. Again, there was substantial documentary evidence in this case. There's no reason to believe that it was even necessary for the defendants to testify or that if they did, that it made any difference to
them. What about his point that the judicial notice was improper even for the purpose that it was admitted? Because it was out of context, and in context, it could have been demonstrated to be not a sufficient basis, nothing anybody reasonably would have relied on because of other things that were said.
So first of all, I think it's, plaintiff is the master of his complaint. He already included allegations that all of the allegations that he thought were sort of favorable or exculpatory. There's no reason to think that he failed to include any allegations simply because of this question of judicial notice. But on judicial notice, I would say that plaintiff admits even in this very court, he has made a judicial admission that this conversation actually occurred. And I would point the court to the plaintiff's opening brief.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think his argument is, well, then we could have judicially noticed other things that would have tampered.
Right, but there was no need for a plaintiff to rely on judicial notice because he is the master of his complaint. He could have placed any conversation he wanted to.
He could have put the other ones in.
Right, and he did, and he put in the statements about, how he, Emil's, I'm not getting the language precisely right, but something about, criminality is not in his DNA.
But it goes to the
right?
question, as I understand it, of whether the judicial notice that did occur was proper.
I don't think it's improper.
He had no reason to be dealing with that question because, as I understand it, it was the judge who brought this up, the government didn't even argue it. The judge who remembered that this had occurred and was in the record in the Emil Bawari case who brought it up.
I'm sorry. No, I will have to double check, but I believe that's not correct. I believe the government did ask to judicially notice the statements in its response brief, and I believe that plaintiff made a response to that in his reply brief, again, without asking for additional judicial notice of any other statements, which in any event would not have been necessary.
Okay. The time's up. If you want to conclude briefly.
If the court has no further questions, we ask that the judgment of the district court in both cases be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Counsel relies upon what he calls the presumption of grand jury regularity. The only witnesses to the events in the hotel room was the agent, the informant, and the defendant. So I think it not completely crazy to suggest that a claim as to statements must be based on the testimony of one of those participants. The second thing I need to say is the whole idea that the government invokes the principle of regularity is, in this case, somewhat crazy. The case was dismissed because of the grossest form of investigative misconduct on the part of the government. The government informant was permitted to defraud two of the defendants by the most outrageous forms of lies. The government agents themselves repeatedly engaged in the most lurid, outrageous, sexist forms of conduct, taking full advantage of their scope as undercover agents. This is a case that cries out for discovery, and it cries out for a remedy of a person who was, because of his unfortunate presence on one occasion, brought into this case and deprived of a year and a half of his life. His presence in the room, by the way, was at the behest of the agents who told Emil, why don't you have your brother get it? Emil said, no, I have the money counter downstairs. And the agent said, well, don't you get it. Just have your brother bring it up. I asked the court to reverse this matter and allow us to go forward with the case. I appreciate Your Honor's attention this morning.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments in the case. The case is now submitted.